Green Mars, cassette 11.
In Prometheus, they were joined by Jackie Boone herself, who had been left there by friends traveling through. She wanted to go directly on to Gamete, but she was willing to travel with Nadia rather than wait longer, and Nadia was willing to take her. So when they took off again, they had Jackie with them. The easy camaraderie of the first part of their journey disappeared. Jackie and Nergal had parted in Sabishi with their relationship in its usual unsettled, undefined state, and Nergal was displeased to have the growth of his new friendships interrupted. Art was obviously agog at her physical presence. She was actually taller than he was and heavier than Nergal, and Art watched her in a way he thought surreptitious, but which the others were all aware of, including Jackie, of course. It made Nadia roll her eyes, and she and Jackie quarreled over little things like sisters. Once after they did, and Jackie and Nadia were elsewhere in one of Nadia's shelters, Art whispered to Nergal, "She's just like Maya. Doesn't she remind you? The voice, the mannerisms?" Nergal laughed. "Tell her that, and she'll kill you." "Ah," Art said. He regarded Nergal with a sidelong glance. "So you two are still..." Nergal shrugged. In a way, it was interesting. He had told Art enough about his relationship with Jackie that the older man knew there was something fundamental between the two. Now Jackie was almost certain to come on to Art, to add him to her minions, as she routinely did with men she liked or thought important. At this point, she hadn't figured out how important Art was, but when she did, she would act in her usual way, and then what would Art do? So their voyage was no longer the same, Jackie imparting her usual spin to things. She argued with Nergal and Nadia. She casually rubbed up to Art, charming him at the same time she judged him, just as an automatic part of acquaintanceship. She would pull off her shirt to sponge down in Nadia's shelters, or put a hand to his arm when asking questions about Terra, then, at other times, ignore him completely, veering off into worlds of her own. It was like living with a big cat in the rover, a panther that might purr in your lap or bat you across the compartment, but either way, stalk about in a perfect nervous grace. Ah, but that was Jackie. And there was her laugh ringing through the car at things Art or Nadia said, and her beauty, and her intense enthusiasm for discussing the Martian situation, so that when she discovered what they were doing on this trip, she immediately fell into it. Life was heightened with her around, no doubt about it, and Art, though he goggled at her when she bathed, had what Nergal suspected was a sly edge to his smile as he enjoyed her mesmerizing attentions, and once Nergal caught him giving a look to Nadia that was positively amused. So, though he liked her well enough, and liked looking at her, he didn't seem hopelessly smitten. This was possibly a matter of his friendship with Nergal. Nergal couldn't be sure, but he liked the idea, which hadn't been a common one in either Zygote or Sabishi. For her part, Jackie seemed inclined to dismiss Art as a factor in the organizing of a general meeting, as if she would take it over herself. But then they visited a small neo-Marxist sanctuary in the mountains of Mitchell, which were no more mountainous than the rest of the southern highlands, the name being an artifact of the telescope era, and these neo-Marxists proved to be in communication with the city of Bologna in Italy, and with the Indian province of Kerala, and with Praxis offices in both these places. So they had a lot to talk about with Art, and they obviously enjoyed it, and at the end of the visit one of them said to him, "It's wonderful what you're doing. You're just like John Boone." Jackie jerked her head around to stare at Art, who was sheepishly shaking his head. "No, he's not," she said automatically. But after that she treated him more seriously. Nergal could only laugh. Any mention of the name John Boone was like a magic spell to Jackie. When she and Nadia discussed John's theories, he could understand a little why she felt that way. Much of what John had wanted from Mars made excellent sense, and it seemed to him that Sabishi, in particular, was a kind of Boonian space. For Jackie, however, It went beyond a rational response. It had to do with Kasei and Esther and Hiroko, even Peter, with some complex of feelings that touched her on a level that nothing else did. They continued north into lands even more violently disarranged than those they had left behind. This was the volcanic country, where the harsh sublimity of the southern highland was augmented by the ancient craggy peaks of Australis Tholus and Amphitrites Patera. The two volcanoes bracketed a region of lava flows where the blackish rock of the land was frozen in weird lumps, waves, and rivers. Once these flows had poured over the surface in streams of white-hot fluid, and even now, hard and black and shattered by the ages and covered with dust and ice flowers, the liquid origins were completely evident. The most prominent of these lava remnants were long, low ridges like dragon tails now fossilized to solid black rock. These ridges snaked across the land for many kilometers, often disappearing over the horizon in both directions, forcing the travelers to make long detours. These dorsa were ancient lava channels. The rock they were made of had proved harder than the countryside they had originally flowed over, and in the eons since, the countryside had been worn away, leaving the black mounds lying on the surface somewhat like the fallen elevator cable, only very much larger. One of the dorsa in the Dorsa Brevia region had recently been turned into a hidden sanctuary. So Nadia drove their rover on a tortuous path through outlying lava ridges and then into a capacious garage in the side of the largest black mound they had seen. They got out of their car and were greeted by a small group of friendly strangers, several of whom Jackie had met before. There was no indication in the garage that the chamber beyond it was going to be any different from any other they had visited, and so when they walked into a big cylindrical lock and out the other door, it was a great shock to find before them an open space that clearly occupied the whole interior of the ridge. The ridge was hollow. The empty space inside it was roughly cylindrical, a tube perhaps 200 meters floor to ceiling, 300 meters wall to wall, and extending for as far as they could see in both directions. Art's mouth was like a cross-section model of the tunnel. "Wow!" he kept exclaiming. "Wow, look at this! Wow!" Quite a few dorsa were hollow, their hosts told them. Lava tunnels. There were many of them on Terra, but the usual 2-magnitude scale jump obtained, and this tube was in fact 100 times bigger than the biggest Terran tube. When the lava streams had flowed, a young woman named Ariadne explained to Art, they had cooled and hardened at their edges and then on their surfaces, after which hot lava had continued to run through the sleeve until the flows had stopped and the remaining lava had emptied out onto some lake of fire, leaving behind cylindrical caves that were sometimes 50 kilometers long. The floor of this particular tunnel was approximately flat, and now it was covered by rooftops and grassy parks, ponds, and hundreds of young trees planted in groves of mixed bamboo and pine. Long cracks in the roof of the tunnel had served as the basis for filtered skylights made of layered materials which gave off the same visual and thermal signals as the rest of the ridge, but let into the tunnel long curtains of sunny brown air, so that even the dimmest sections of the tunnel were only as dim as a cloudy day. Dorsa Brevia's tunnel was 40 kilometers long, Ariadne informed them as they walked down a staircase, although there were places where the roof had caved in, or plugs of lava almost filled the cavity. "We haven't closed off the whole thing, of course. It's more than we need, and more than we could keep warm and pumped anyway. But we've closed off about 12 kilometers now in kilometer-long segments with tent fabric bulkheads between them." "Wow!" Art said again. Nirgal felt just as impressed, and Nadia was clearly delighted. Even Vishniak was nothing compared to this. Jackie was already near the bottom of the long staircase that led from the garage lock to a park below them. As they followed her, Art said, "Every colony you've taken me to, I've figured has to be the biggest one, and I'm always wrong. Why don't you just tell me now if the next one is going to be like all of Hellas Basin or something? Nadia laughed. This is the biggest one I know of. Bigger. So why do you all stay in Gamete when it's so cold and small and dim? Couldn't the people from all the sanctuaries fit into this space? We don't want to all be in one place, she replied. As for this one, it wasn't even here a few years ago. Down on the floor of the tunnel, they appeared to be in a forest under a black stone sky rent by long, jagged, bright cracks. The four travelers followed a group of their hosts to a complex of buildings with thin wooden walls and steep roofs upturned at the corners. In one of these, they were introduced to a group of elderly women and men in colorful, baggy clothing and invited to share a meal. As they ate, they learned more about the sanctuary, mostly from Ariadne, who sat beside them. It had been built and occupied by the descendants of people who had come to Mars and joined the disappeared in the 2050s, leaving the cities and occupying small refuges in this region, aided in their efforts by the Savishians. They had been heavily influenced by Hiroko's Areophany, and their society was described by some as a matriarchy. They had studied some ancient matriarchal cultures and based some of their customs on the ancient Minoan civilization and the Hopi of North America. Thus, they worshipped a goddess who represented life on Mars, something like a personification of Hiroko's Viriditas or a deification of Hiroko herself. And in daily life, the women owned the households and would pass them on to their youngest daughters. Ultimogeniture, Ariadne called it, a custom of the Hopi. And as with the Hopi, men moved into their wives' houses on marriage. Do the men like it? Art asked curiously. Ariadne laughed at his expression. There's nothing like happy women for making happy men, that's what we say. And she gave Art a look that seemed to pull him right over the bench toward her. Makes sense to me, Art said. We all share the work, extending the tunnel segments, farming, raising the children, whatever needs doing. Everybody tries to get good at more than just their specialty, which is a custom that comes from the first 100, I think, and the Savishians. Art nodded. And how many of you are there? About 4,000 now. Art whistled his surprise. That afternoon, they were taken down the tunnel through several kilometers of transformed segments, many of them forested, and all containing a large stream that ran down the floor of the tunnel, widening in some segments to form big ponds. When Ariadne brought them back up to the first chamber called Zekros, almost 1,000 people showed up for an open-air meal in the largest park. Nergal and Art wandered around talking to people, enjoying a plain meal of bread and salad and broiled fish. The people there appeared receptive to the idea of a Congress of the Underground. They had tried something like it years before, but had not gotten many takers at the time, had lists of the sanctuaries in their region, and one of the older women said, with authority, that they would be happy to host it, as they had a space large enough to handle a great number of guests. Oh, that would be marvelous, Art said, glancing at Ariadne. Later, Nadia agreed. It will help a lot, she said. A lot of people will be resistant to the idea of a meeting because they suspect the first 100 of trying to take charge of the underground. But if it's held here and the Bogdanovists are behind it... When Jackie came over and heard of the offer, she gave Art a hug. Oh, it's going to happen! And it's just what John Boone would have done. It's like the meeting he called on Olympus Mons. They left Dorsa Brevia and headed north again on the east side of the Hellas Basin. During the nights of this drive, Jackie often brought out John Boone's AI, Pauline, which she had studied and cataloged. She played back selections from his thoughts about an independent state, which were disorganized and rambling, the reflections of a man with more enthusiasm, and Omegendorf, than analytic ability. But sometimes he would get on a roll and ad-lib in the manner of the famous speeches, and that could be fascinating. He had had a knack for free association which made his ideas sound like logical progression even when they weren't. "See how often he talks about the Swiss," Jackie said. She sounded like John, Nergal noticed suddenly. She had been working with Pauline extensively for a long time, and her manner had been affected by it. John's voice, Maya's manner. In such ways, they carried the past with them. "We have to make sure some Swiss are at the Congress." "We've got Jürgen and the group at Overhangs," Nadia said. "But they're not really so Swiss, are they?" "You'll have to ask them," Nadia said. "But if you mean Swiss officials, there are a lot of them in Burrows, and they've been helping us there without ever even talking to us about it. About 50 of us have Swiss passports now. They're a big part of the Demimonde." "As is Praxis," Art put in. "Yes, yes. Anyway, we'll talk to the group at Overhangs. They'll have contacts with the surface Swiss, I'm sure." Northeast of the volcano Hadraica Patera, they visited a town that had been founded by Sufis. The original structure was built into the side of a canyon cliff in a kind of high-tech Mesa Verde. A thin line of buildings, inserted into the breakpoint where the cliff's imposing overhang began to slope back out and down to the canyon floor. Steep staircases in walk tubes ran down the lower slope to a small concrete garage, and around the garage had sprung up a number of blister tents and greenhouses. These tents were occupied by people who wished to study with the Sufis. Some came from the sanctuaries, some from the cities of the north. Many were natives, but quite a few were newcomers from Earth. Together they hoped to roof the entire canyon, using materials developed for the new cable to support an immense spread of tent fabric. Nadia was immediately drawn into discussions of the construction problems such a project would encounter, which she happily told them would be various and severe. Ironically, the thickening atmosphere made all dome projects more difficult, because the domes couldn't be floated by the air pressures underneath them to the extent they once had been. And though the tensile and load-bearing strengths of the new carbon configurations were more than they would need, anchoring points that would hold such weights as they had in mind would be almost impossible to find. But the local engineers were confident that lighter tent fabrics and new anchoring techniques might serve, and the walls of the canyon, they said, were solid. They were in the very upper reach of rural Vallis, and ancient sapping had cut back into very hard material. Good anchoring points should be everywhere. No attempt was being made to hide any of this activity from satellite observation. The Sufis' circular mesa dwelling in Margaritifer and their main settlement in the south, Rumi, were similarly unconcealed. Yet they had never been harassed in any way by anybody, or even contacted by the transitional authority. This made one of their leaders, a small black man named Duel Noon, think the fears of the underground were exaggerated. Nadia politely disagreed, and when Nergal pressed her on the point, curious about it, she looked at him steadily. "They hunt the first 100. He thought it over, watching the Sufis lead the way up the walk-tube staircases to their cliff dwelling. They had arrived well before dawn, and Du had invited everyone up to the cliff for a brunch to welcome the visitors. So they followed the Sufis up to the dwelling and sat at a great long table in a long room with its outer wall a continuous great window overlooking the canyon. The Sufis dressed in white, while the people from the tents in the canyon wore ordinary jumpers, most of them rust-colored. People poured each other's water and talked as they ate. "You are on your tariqat," Duel Noon said to Nergal. "This was one's spiritual path," he explained, "one's road to reality." Nergal nodded, struck by the aptness of the description. It was just how his life had always felt to him. "You must feel lucky," Du said. "You must pay attention." After a meal of bread and strawberries and yogurt, and then mud-thick coffee, the tables and chairs were cleared, and the Sufis danced a sima, or whirling dance, spinning and chanting to the music of a harpist and several drummers and the chanting of the canyon dwellers. As the dancers passed their guests, they placed their palms very briefly to the guests' cheeks, their touches as light as the brush of a wing. Nergal glanced at Art, expecting him to be as goggle-eyed as he usually was at the various phenomena of Martian life, but in fact he was smiling in a knowing way and tapping his forefinger and thumb together in time to the beat and chanting with the rest. And at the end of the dance he stepped out and recited something in a foreign language which caused the Sufis to smile and, when he was done, to applaud loudly. "Some of my professors in Tehran were Sufis," he explained to Nergal and Nadia and Jackie. "They were a big part of what people call the Persian Renaissance." "And what did you recite?" Nergal asked. "It's a Farsi poem by Jalaluddin Rumi, the master of the whirling dervishes. I never learned the English version very well. I died from a mineral and plant became, died from the plant, took a sentient frame, died from the beast, donned a human dress. When by my dying, did I ever grow less?" "Ah, I can't remember the rest, but some of those Sufis were very good engineers." "They'd better be here, too," Nadia said, glancing at the people she had been talking to about doming the canyon. In any case, the Sufis here proved to be very enthusiastic about the idea of an underground congress. As they pointed out, theirs was a syncretic religion, which had taken some of its elements not only from the various types and nationalities of Islam, but also from the older religions of Asia that Islam had encountered, and also newer ones such as Baha'i. Something similarly flexible was going to be needed here, they said. Meanwhile, their concept of the gift had already been influential throughout the underground, and some of their theoreticians were working with Vlad and Marina on the specifics of eco-economics. So as the morning passed and they waited for the late winter sunrise, standing at the great window and looking across the dark canyon to the east, they were quick to make very practical suggestions about the meeting. "You should go talk to the Bedouin and the other Arabs as quickly as possible," Du told them. "They won't like being late in the list of those consulted." Then the eastern sky lightened very slowly from dark plum to lavender. The opposite cliff was lower than the one they were on, and they could see over the dark plateau to the east for a few kilometers to a low range of hills that formed the horizon. The Sufis pointed out the cleft in the hills where the sun would rise, and some began to chant again. "There is a group of Sufis in Elysium," Du told them, "who are exploring backwards to our roots in Mithraism and Zoroastrianism. Some say there are Mithraists on Mars now, worshipping the sun Ahura Mazda. They consider the Soleta to be religious art, like a stained glass window in a cathedral." When the sky was an intense clear pink, the Sufis gathered around their four guests and gently pushed them into a pattern against the windows, Nergal next to Jackie, Nadia and Art behind them. "Today, you are our stained glass," Du said quietly. Hands lifted Nergal's forearm until his hand was touching Jackie's, and he took it. They exchanged a quick glance and then stared forward to the hills on the horizon. Art and Nadia were likewise holding hands, and their outside hands were placed on Nergal's and Jackie's shoulders. The chanting around them got louder, the chorus of voices intoning words in Farsi, the long and liquid vowels stretching out for minutes on end. And then the sun cracked the horizon and the fountain of light exploded over the land, pouring in the wide window and over them, so that they had to squint and their eyes watered. Between the Soleta and the thickening atmosphere, the sun was visibly larger than it had been in the past, bronze and oblate and shimmering up through the horizontal slicing of distant inversion layers. Jackie squeezed Nergal's hand hard, and on an impulse he looked behind them, There on the white wall, all their shadows made a kind of linked tapestry, black on white, and in the intensity of the light, the white nearest their shadows was the brightest white of all, tinged just barely by the colors of the rainbow glory, embracing them all. They took the Sufi's advice when they left and headed for the Lyle Mohol, one of the 470-degree south latitude Mohols. In this region, the Bedouin from western Egypt had located a number of caravanserai, and Nadia was acquainted with one of their leaders, so they decided to try and find him. As they drove, Nergal thought hard about the Sufis and what their influential presence said about the underground and the demimonde. People had left the surface world for many different reasons, and that was important to remember. All of them had thrown everything away and risked their lives, but they had done so intent on very different goals. Some hoped to establish radically new cultures, as in Zygote or Dorsa Brevia, or in the Bogdanovist sanctuaries. Others, like the Sufis, wanted to hold on to ancient cultures they felt were under assault in the Terran global order. Now all these parts of the resistance were scattered in the southern highlands, mixed, but still separate. There was no obvious reason why they should all want to become one single thing. Many of them had been trying specifically to get away from dominant powers, transnationals, the West, America, capitalism, all the totalizing systems of power. A central system was just what they had gone to great lengths to get away from. That did not bode well for Art's plan, and when Nergal expressed this worry, Nadia agreed. "You are American. This is trouble for us," which made Art go cross-eyed. But then Nadia added, "Well, America also stands for the melting pot, the idea of the melting pot. It was the place where people could come from anywhere and be a part of it. Such was the theory. There are lessons there for us." Jackie said, "What Boone finally concluded was that it wasn't possible to invent a Martian culture from scratch. He said it should be a mix of the best of everyone that came here. That's the difference between Boonians and Bogdanovists." "Yes," Nadia said, frowning, "but I think they were both wrong. I don't think we can invent it from scratch, and I don't think there will be a mix. At least not for a very long time. In the meantime, it will be a matter of a lot of different cultures coexisting, I think. But whether such a thing is possible..." She shrugged. The problems they were going to face in any Congress were made flesh during their visit to the Bedouin caravanserai. These Bedouin were mining the region of the far south between Dana Crater, Lyle Crater, the Sisyphe Cavi, and Dorsa Argentia. They were traveling about in mobile mining rigs in the style honed on the Great Escarpment, now traditional, harvesting surface deposits and then moving on. The caravanserai was just a small tent left in place like an oasis for people to use in emergencies or when they wanted to stretch out a little. Nobody could have made more of a contrast with the ethereal Sufis than the Bedouin. These reserved, unsentimental Arabs dressed in modern jumpers and seemed to be mostly male. When the travelers arrived, there was a mining caravan about to leave, and when they heard what the travelers wanted to discuss, they frowned and left anyway. "More Boonism. We don't want anything to do with it." The travelers ate a meal with a group of men in the largest rover left in the caravanserai, with women appearing from a tube from the car next door to serve the dishes. Jackie glowered at this with a dark expression that was straight off Maya's face. When one of the younger Arab men sitting beside her tried to strike up a conversation, he found it hard going indeed. Nergal suppressed a smile at this and attended to Nadia and an old Bedou named Zayk, the leader of this group, and the one Nadia had known from before. "Ah, the Sufis," he said genially. "No one bothers them because they are clearly harmless, like birds." Later in the meal, Jackie warmed to the young Arab, of course, as he was a strikingly handsome man, with long dark eyelashes framing liquid brown eyes, an aquiline nose, full red lips, a sharp jaw, and an easy, confident manner that appeared unintimidated by Jackie's own beauty, which was similar in some ways to his own. His name was Antar, and he came from an important Bedou family. Art, sitting across the low table from them, looked shocked at this developing friendship, but after their years in Sabishi, Nergal had seen it coming even before Jackie had, and in a strange way it was almost a pleasure to watch her at work. Quite a sight, in fact. She, the proud daughter of the greatest matriarchies since Atlantis, Antar, the proud heir of the most extreme patriarchy on Mars, a young man with a grace and ease of manner so pure it was as if he were the king of the world. After the meal, the two of them disappeared. Nergal settled back with scarcely a twinge and talked with Nadia and Art and Zake and Zake's wife, Nazik, who came out to join them. Zake and Nazik were Mars old-timers who had met John Boone and been friends of Frank Chalmers. Contrary to the Sufi's prediction, they were very friendly to the idea of a Congress, and they agreed that Dorsa Brevia would be a good place to hold it. "What we need is equality without conformity," Zake said at one point, squinting seriously as he chose his words. This was close enough to what Nadia had been saying on the drive there that it caught Nergal's attention even more than it otherwise would have. "This is not an easy thing to establish, but clearly we have to try to avoid fighting. I'll spread the word through the Arab community, or at least the Bedou. I must say there are Arabs in the north who are very much involved with the transnationals, with Amex especially. All the African Arab countries are falling into Amex, one after the next. A very odd pairing. But money..." He rubbed his fingers together. "You know. Anyway, we will contact our friends, and the Sufis will help us. They are becoming the mullahs down here, and the mullahs don't like it, but I do." Other developments worried him. "Armscor has taken on the Black Sea Group, and that's a very bad combination. Old Afrikaner leadership and security from all the member states, most of them police states, Ukraine, Georgia, Moldova, Azerbaijan, Armenia, Bulgaria, Turkey, Romania." He ticked them off on his fingers, wrinkling his nose. "Think about those histories for a while. And they have been building bases on the Great Escarpment, a band around Mars in effect. And they're in tight with the Transitional Authority." He shook his head. "They will crush us if they can." Nadia nodded her agreement, and Art, looking surprised at this assessment, pumped Zake with 100 questions. "But you don't hide," he noted at one point. "We have sanctuaries if we need them," Zake said, "and we are ready to fight." "Do you think it will come to that?" Art asked. "I am sure of it." Much later, after several more tiny cups of mud-like coffee, Zake and Nazik and Nadia talked to each other about Frank Chalmers, all three of them smiling peculiar fond smiles. Nergal and Art listened, but it was hard to get a sense of that man, dead long before Nergal had been born. In fact, it was a shocking reminder of just how old the Issei were, that they had known such a figure from the videotapes. Finally, Art blurted out, "But what was he like?" The three old ones thought it over. Slowly, Zake said, "He was an angry man. He listened to Arabs, though, and respected us. He lived with us for a time and learned our language, and truthfully, there are few Americans who have ever done that. And so we loved him. But he was no very easy man to know. And he was angry. I don't know why. Something in his years on Earth, I suppose. He never spoke of them. In fact, he never spoke about himself at all. But there was a gyroscope in him, spinning like a pulsar. And he had black moods, very black. We sent him out in scouting rovers to see if he could help himself. It didn't always work. He would rip us from time to time, even though he was our guest. Zake smiled, remembering. Once he called us all slave owners right to our faces over coffee. Slave owners? Zake waved a hand. He was angry. He saved us there at the end, Nadia told Zake, stirring from deep in her own thoughts. In 61. She told them of a long drive down Valles Marineris, accomplished at the very same time that the Compton Aquifer outbreak was flooding the Great Canyon, and how, when they were almost clear of it, the flood had caught Frank and swept him away. He was out getting the car off a rock, and if he hadn't acted so quickly, the whole car would have gone. Ah, said Zake, a happy death. I don't think he thought so. The Issei all laughed briefly, then reached together for their empty cups and made a small toast to their late friend. I miss him, Nadia said as she put her cup down. I never thought I would say that. She went silent, and watching her, Nergal felt the night cosseting them, hiding them. He had never heard her speak of Frank Chalmers. A lot of her friends had died in the revolt. And her partner, too, Bogdanov, whom so many people still followed. Angry to the last, Zake said. For Frank, a happy death. From Lyle, they continued counterclockwise around the South Pole, stopping at sanctuaries or tent towns and exchanging news and goods. Christianopolis was the largest tent town in the region, center of trade for all the smaller settlements south of Argyre. The sanctuaries in the area were mostly occupied by Reds. Nadia asked all the Reds they met to convey news of the Congress to Anne Claiborne. We're supposed to have a phone link, but she's not answering me. A lot of the Reds clearly thought a meeting was a bad idea, or at least a waste of time. South of Schmidt Crater, they stopped at a settlement of Bologna communists who lived in a hollowed-out hill, lost in one of the wildest zones of the southern highlands, a region very hard to travel in because of the many wandering scarps and dikes which rovers couldn't negotiate. The Bolognese gave them a map marking some tunnels and elevators they had installed in the area to allow passage through dikes and up or down scarps. If we didn't have them, our trips would be nothing but detours. Located next to one of their hidden dike tunnels was a small colony of Polynesians living in a short lava tunnel which they had floored with water and three islands. The dike was piled high with ice and snow on its southern flank, but the Polynesians, most of whom were from the island of Vanuatu, kept the interior of their refuge at homey temperatures, and Nergal found the air so hot and humid that it was hard to breathe, even when just sitting on a sand beach between a black lake and a line of tilting palm trees. Clearly, he thought as he looked around, the Polynesians could be counted among those trying to build a culture incorporating some aspects of their archaic ancestors. They also proved to be scholars of primitive government everywhere in Earth's history, and they were excited at the idea of sharing what they had learned in these studies at the Congress, so it was no problem getting them to agree to come. To celebrate the idea of the Congress, they had gathered for a feast on the beach. Art, seated between Jackie and a Polynesian beauty named Tana, beamed blissfully as he sipped from a half-coconut shell filled with kava. Nergal lay stretched out on the sand before them, listening as Jackie and Tana talked animatedly about the indigenous movement, as Tana called it. This was not any simple back-to-the-past nostalgia, she said, but rather an attempt to invent new cultures which incorporated aspects of early civilizations into high-tech Martian forms. The underground itself is a kind of Polynesia, Tana said. Little islands in a great stone ocean, some on the maps, some not. And someday it will be a real ocean, and we'll be out on the islands, flourishing under the sky. I'll drink to that, Art said, and did. Clearly, one part of the archaic Polynesian culture that Art hoped they were incorporating was their renowned sexual friendliness. But Jackie was mischievously complicating things by leaning on Art's arm, either to tease him or to compete with Tana. Art was looking happy but concerned. He had drunk his cup of the noxious kava fairly quickly, and between that and the women appeared lost in a blissful confusion. Nergal nearly laughed out loud. It seemed possible that some of the other young women at the feast might also be interested in sharing the archaic wisdom, judging by their glances his way. On the other hand, Jackie might leave off teasing Art. It didn't matter. It was going to be a long night, and New Vanuatu's little tunnel ocean was kept as warm as the old zygote baths. Nadia was already out there swimming in the shallows with some men a quarter her age. Nergal stood and pulled off his clothes, walked out into the water.
This ends side one of cassette 11. Please turn the cassette over and start side two at the same point.